Good morning, Old South.
Good morning.
It is indeed my honor and pleasure to be here with you today. I bring you greetings from the National Office of the United Church of Christ, where Reverend John Dorhauer is our General Minister and President. I feel especially blessed to be with you today, because it is not often that one gets to say thank you in person to people that they never knew that they would get to see and meet. You see, 4 years ago, I served as the pastor of Christ the King United Church of Christ in Florissant, Missouri, 3 miles from Ferguson, where Michael Brown Jr. was killed. And in the midst of the turmoil and the distrust and the dis-ease of my community, we found ourselves as a church on the front line fighting for justice for people in our community. We did not have a plan. We had no warning that we would find ourselves there. We spent much time in prayer because we spent much time in confusion trying to discern what we should do and how we should do it as a community of people of God. It was often an isolating time as we saw our city become more racially polarized than ever. And in the midst of that, we received a visit, an angel I would like to call her, from Old South, who was carrying peace cranes that had been sent to us from you. Peace cranes that you had received and that you passed on to us as a constant reminder that we were not alone, that prayers were ascending, that even those we did not know were holding us in their hearts and minds. So as the pastor of Christ the King, as we did in a letter, but now I get to do in person, I thank you. You will never know how many days walking into our sanctuary as we held not just spiritual gatherings, but also political gatherings, communal gatherings to help bring a sense of calm. You will never know how many conversations we had because of those peace cranes fluttering around, and what a sense of peace they indeed did help to usher in St. Louis, in Ferguson, where it was so deeply needed. And 1 year later, we followed your lead and sent the peace cranes on to another United Church of Christ, deeply in pain at the time. Please accept from me acknowledgement that the work that you do matters, not just here, but a long way from here in Ferguson, Missouri. Please pray with me. Gracious God, it is preaching time, and I am completely aware that preaching does not happen without your spirit. Preparation happens, yes, and I've done that. Getting here happens, yes, I've done that. But preaching, the changing and the transformation of the word that it might permeate our hearts and our minds, only happens under the Spirit. So let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Yesterday, I joined thousands of people at the Poor People's March and rally in Washington, D.C., as Reverend Nancy has shared. Perhaps some of you were there. I know that some of you were there. And the UCC was well represented. The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, is a recognition and and a reigniting of the Poor People's Campaign that have become the emerging focus of Dr. Martin Luther King's work at the time of his death. The rally and the march yesterday marked the culmination of 3 years of planning and prayer and 40 consecutive days of direct action over 40 states. It was not an ending of the campaign, but really a launching of the next division of the campaign. You see, our country is once again in a state of upheaval, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you that. According to a recent UC Berkeley study, income disparities have become so pronounced that America's top 10% now average more than 9 times as much income as the bottom 90%. Americans in the top 1% tower stunningly higher. The average over 40 times more income than the bottom 90%. But that gap pales into comparison to the divide between the nation's top 0.1% and everybody else. Americans at this lofty level are taking in over 198 times the income of everybody else. Access to quality health care and education are becoming increasingly difficult in our nation. Black and brown immigrant human rights in this country, and indeed all over this world, are threatened. And who would imagine that here in the United States, we would once again, and I do say again, be separating children from their parents and caging them in facilities that, even if adequately and appropriately staffed, leave frightened children without the care and nurturing necessary for healthy development. Voting rights are increasingly attacked, and attempts to criminalize non-white citizens because of their race or their faith or their economic status are on the rise. Efforts to roll back hard-won LGBTQ rights are underway. In spite of increased awareness and inclusion by many in society. And like it or not, if those of us who believe in the inherent value of all human beings, regardless of race, gender, sexuality, religion, disabilities, or economic status, if we are quiet, we could very well become, once again, a nation where the subjugation and annihilation of people is not only acceptable, but sanctioned by a misinterpretation and misappropriation of sacred texts and a holy God whose desire is that all people live lives of wholeness and well-being. This is why I believe the Spirit led me to the book of Esther for our time together this morning. I've grown to love the book of Esther because despite the obvious handprint of God on the actions and impact of the witness recorded there, the name of God is never mentioned in the entire book. Why does this matter to me so much at this time? Because we live in a time when the name of God and the quoting of Scripture are used to justify so many evil actions. Esther is a faithful reminder to us that we should seek to embody our faith in demonstrable ways that do not require us to yell God's name, to wear God's name, to put a bumper sticker on our car, to hang a cross around our neck, for people to know that we are indeed the embodiment of the gospel. In today's text, the Jews are in exile under Persian rule. And Haman, a prophet, resents the fact that the Jews refuse to conform to Persian practices or worship in Persian ways or willingly allow themselves to be subjugated under Persian rule. This behavior infuriates Haman so much that Haman sets in motion a plan to kill all of the exiled Jews. A day at the end of the year was appointed for this purpose. The 30th day, the text says, of the month of Adar. And with the king's approval, messengers went out through the land for the people to be ready for slaughter. The city of Susa, where most of the Jews lived, was stunned by the royal edict. None of them saw it coming. And the initial response of God's people to the threat, the first response was one in the public square. The equivalent today would be to write letters to the newspaper, both local and national, or to do a public phone-in and block the lines to government power, or to write petitions, or to approach the government directly, to visit state and federal capitals. This was their version of that in their time. This is the first response to the information, protest, and the maximum emotional impact. So we're told that when Mordecai, a Jewish leader, learned of the plan, he tore his clothes, he put on sackcloth and ashes, and he went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. Mordecai had learned of all that was planned in the destruction of the people. He got the facts, and then he made this calculated response. Tearing his clothes and covering his head and face and shoulders with white ash and going out wailing. It was a brave action, defying the king's decree. Mordecai took his loud protest as far as the gate, as I've told you, because Mordecai understood that all that is necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men and women to do nothing. His action was the trigger for similar public demonstrations held in every province of the empire. However, Mordecai's target with his public protest was not what others may have thought it was. He was focused on one person in particular, his adopted daughter Esther, who had become the wife of King Xerxes. Mordecai wanted to gain her attention in the palace so that she would know the people, her people, were in trouble. So Mordecai gave Esther the information about the planned massacre that he had received. And then he told her what she had to do. You have got to go into the king's presence and beg for mercy and plead with him for your people. That's Mordecai's initial response. We would like to have read that he had gone to God three times a day and prayed. But there's no mention of that. Mordecai's initial response was civil protest and family connections, friends in high places. Some of them, of us, have them. No doubt we can appeal to those things as long as they are in the context of personal dependence on God. Esther's initial response was hesitant. She was overwhelmed by Mordecai's request. There was no pillow talk.
president in over a month.
And the only way I get to see him is if he summons me into his presence. She's confessing how few the privileges marriage to the king have brought to her life. I'm no different from anyone else in the citadel, she says. All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman, including me, to approach the king in the inner court unless they are summoned, the king has but one law: off with your head. When Mordecai hears of Esther's fears, Mordecai sends her a message that she knows to be true. Do not think that because you're in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to this royal position you hold, except for such a time as this. The question I pose to you, my friends, is how do we maintain our witness of faith in a culture dominated by material consumption and political brinkmanship? Mordecai is telling her, and he is also informing us, when we are under any kind of threat, that we are compelled to do three things. Three things. First, we must face our fears. This is a candid wake-up call because Esther obviously assumes that her own life is not in danger as long as she doesn't break with protocol. She thinks that she would be immune from the death threat in Haman's decree. So Mordecai tells her the truth. The reality is that there are no loopholes in the coming annihilation. Every Jew is on death row in this text. There will be no exceptions. The edict is terrible in its thoroughness to destroy and kill and annihilate young and old, women and little children on a single day. Don't you deceive yourself, Esther, that it means everybody but you. The laws of the Medes and the Persians are set in country. There had been no escape clause for the previous queen, Vashti, even though the law she had broken wasn't even made until after she broke it. So what hope will Esther have in breaking a law that's already in force? Mordecai is saying to his daughter, his adopted daughter, you can run, but you can't hide. So you might as well face your fears. And you can't sit on the fence either. That's number two. Esther, you have to make a choice, Mordecai tells her, because if you remain silent at this time, there will be deliverance from somewhere else. How can he be so confident of that? He can be so confident of that because this is not the first time. And every time, regardless of the faithlessness of people, God remains faithful. So he knows that whether or not Esther does what this moment calls for her to do, he knows that God will have someone, God will have some way of saving the people. This is not about what God can or cannot do. It's about what role she is willing to play in the liberation that God has set forth. This is about her seizing is what Mordecai is saying. Who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this? Do you think it's merely coincidental that you are sitting in a place of privilege when people need help? Do you think it's merely coincidental that your husband, the king, owes his life to a Jew, to me, your cousin? In other words, Mordecai suggests that she stops looking only at the negative side. She must stop considering only the risks that are involved. Esther needs to recognize the very real advantages she has. In God's providence, Esther is better placed than anybody else to meet the needs of the moment. First, it was corporate. By Mordecai's words, she had again been made conscious of the people to whom she belonged, that she, like them, was under threat for her faith, and that she was united with them, trusting in the living God alone. Because if we tell the truth, we are all connected. She had been awakened to the fact of her solidarity with this group of people facing destruction, and she also needed help from this body. So she said to Mordecai, okay, you go and gather everybody up, everybody who's living in Susa, and tell them to fast for me. Because even when we know we have to do difficult things, even after we decide we're going to take a difficult stand, sometimes we need to know other folk are praying for our courage and our strength. Has anybody been there before? Don't eat for 3 days. Don't drink for 3 days. And I will have my maids and myself. We will all fast together. Fasting, a common practice in our biblical text. In fasting, we deny self and we bring our body and our desires under subjection to the will of God. We bear witness to the contrition of our hearts, and we put ourselves in mind of our weakness in every situation. Esther was fearful, but at first she could only see the difficulty. So she needed this time of focused concentration, of single-mindedness with God, so that she could feel her connection and her need for liberation as well. Her second response was personal. She said, Mordecai, when this fast is over, I will go to the king. And even though it's against the law, if I perish, I perish. We don't have to live, but we do have to serve God. We dare not forget that we are members of one body, of one flock, of one family of God. So we must always ask ourselves, are our lives supporting others? We mustn't just live for ourselves. We always have to live with a view of those we are connected to in our sight. And sometimes, my friends, love for our neighbor, even when we are safe, will require us to risk something, to risk ourselves. I used to think that getting arrested in D.C. was a risk for me. I've done it several times, enough times so that the last time I showed up, the intake officer said, not you again. I don't think so much of that anymore. As I am reminded every time I'm locked up with people who don't wear a collar, that I am going in expecting to get out. I'm going in expecting not to be harmed. I've actually been arrested here, not in Boston, but in DC, and they said, Reverend, we'll just leave the door open. Just don't leave. I doubt if every guest gets that invitation. I don't consider it such a risk. Well, I didn't. The last crew that got arrested, they lost their paperwork in the process. So they were there for 29 hours with no food and no water and limited access to the restroom and roaches crawling up and down the walls and no soft place to lay their head. And yet they also remembered that they would eventually get out. And there were others for whom the future was not as sure. So sometimes, like Esther, we are called to take risk. And every time I begin to think, oh, this risk is a little too great, I would be lying if I said, when we went around the police officers yesterday trying to deliver our petitions, I would be lying if I didn't think about those roaches and my great fear of them. And that it was a Saturday and that I might be stuck inside until Monday. But then I remembered that a part of our discipleship call is to sometimes do the stuff we don't really want to do. I remember Jesus himself went to God and asked, is there any possibility that we can choose another way to fix this humanity thing? Is there another way that we can do this? Is there a possibility that this cup could pass from me? But then, having prayed that prayer, he immediately added these words, nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done. I would say that that was Jesus' way of saying, if I perish, then let me perish. Corporate prayer and personal prayer are important in this journey. And I offer you Esther's journey because we are living in a time where we must make some decisions of our own. And perhaps our connections are not in the palace. Perhaps our connections are not in the White House. Perhaps we are being called to help usher in a movement of safety, a movement of sanctity, a movement of preservation for all the people because we are connected. And maybe the difficult conversations we have to have are not in the Hall of Congress and not in the newspaper. Maybe they're at the kitchen table. Maybe they're at the family reunion. Maybe they're at the boards that we sit on. Maybe they're in the council meetings of our church. I don't know where your influence is, but I do know that you are in position for such a time as this. I do know that if we don't fight to save and preserve the children who have been taken at the border in this moment, that there will be no protection for ours. I do know. I do know if we don't fight for the voting rights of every person, that there is no guarantee you will be voting years from now. I do know. I do know if we don't stand against the incarceration of people for the purpose of profit, that eventually there won't be any more of them to lock up. And then they will come for us. I do know. I do know.
that if those of us who see a different view of God, who understand a different way of the scriptures, who profess a God who opens doors and doesn't close them, who tears down walls and doesn't build them, who extends invitation to a table and doesn't tell anyone they're not worthy, I do know that if we don't make that God know that we are headed for a place we do not want to be. I shared in the first service a story from my own congregation, and I leave it here with you, because I know what I am asking is difficult for some and easy for others. I don't suffer under any illusion that it's easy to speak truth to power. I don't suffer any illusion that that's easy, even if you know that truth is the power. I don't suffer under any illusion that the truth doesn't sometimes separate us from people we care about and people we love. I don't think it's easy to be the only one in a neighborhood or the only one at a dinner table or the only one in a room with everybody else who thinks you have gone mad and continue to speak truth in love. I don't think any of that is easy. And I think sometimes we don't do it, not because we don't know, not because we don't believe, but just because we don't want to take the risk. So this past Easter in my church, there was the children's Easter performances. And the very first speech giver was a 6-year-old named Elijah. Elijah had been perfect in rehearsals, but on Sunday morning, nothing. He got to the mic and he began to cry. And in spite of the Sunday school teacher encouraging him, he cried. And in spite of his parents coming up, he cried. And in spite of the pastor coming down and holding his hand, he cried even louder and added a no. So I said, okay, it's fine. You can go have a seat and we'll let the other children speak. And we did. We went on with the program. And just as I was thanking everyone and about to do the benediction, I hear from the pew a loud, wait! It's Elijah. I want to give my speech now. I said, okay. He comes up to the mic, sticks out his chest, and he recites his 3 lines perfectly. The congregation begins to applaud. And after the program was over, I make a beeline to Elijah, and I grab him up and I hug him and I congratulate him on gaining the courage to do his speech. And then I ask him, what finally gave you the courage, Elijah? And he said, nothing. I just did it scared. In these times, my friends, no matter what political aisle you sit on, I don't care. I'm not partisan in that way. We all have sinned and come short. No matter where you sit, conservative or liberal, I don't care. What I know is that this is a moment when we must all unite. And if the fear of uniting for the salvation of others frightens you, renders you incapable of acting, then I leave Elijah's words with you. Do it scared. And know that the God that doesn't need to be warned, the God that doesn't need to be shouted in your every word, the God that is not impressed with our bumper stickers or our slogans, the God who is not requiring you to hang a cross around your neck, will be present and will show up with you, even